Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for March 5th, 2011. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. We are live today from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time in the United States and have guests to discuss and give a situation report on the international mass strike underway. The topic, as we had advertised it, is revulsion or revolution. You can see why as the discussion proceeds. But this was the name of an interview done 10 days ago by LaRouche Political Action Committee TV guests. Chris Landry and John Hofel were glad to welcome here today with us. John Hofel, hi.
Hi, Marcia.
Good. Glad to have you back. It's been a while on this particular show. But with John today, we have on the line Tarana Dorsey. Welcome, Tarana.
Thanks. Hi, Marcia.
Who's traveling from Chicago back to Detroit, Michigan, because Tarana's been hyperactive, I guess I should put it that way, with the LaRouche Political Action Committee in the Great Lakes states in the upper Midwest, with the Bill Roberts for Congress campaign, whose bill is part of the national slate of six LaRouche Political Action Committee congressional candidates giving leadership in this breaking situation. Let me just say right at the beginning, they've issued in the last 24 hours a new joint statement, a leaflet statement, find on LaRouchePAC.com. Tyrants beware, the mass strike is here. And I'll just say right here at the outset, in 5 days, as the leaflet on, please circulate this leaflet, focuses on that on March 10th, Lyndon LaRouche will give an international webcast centered here in Washington, D.C. But it will be March 10th, that's a Thursday at 1 p.m. on LaRouchePAC.com on the United States and Ireland, or might be it's called Ireland and the United States. But the point is clear. Let me just say, by way of introduction, is that if anything, the situation in numbers and intensity is escalating internationally in the wave of mass demonstrations. Yesterday being Friday, a day of prayers throughout much of North Africa and Arabia, in the Maghreb nations, in Egypt, and else in the Persian Gulf, there were literally together hundreds of thousands of protesters from Bahrain, Yemen, in Cairo, Egypt, and elsewhere in Egypt, in Alexandria, Oman, and so forth. And Libya, you can see intense actually fighting there taking place. Here in the United States, if you visualize the map of active on the streets confrontation, some of the lines have been drawn over the resistance in state capitals to allowing these certain kind of newly elected tin pot governors to try and implement really shutting down government functions. Tarana and other and John can talk about this more, but we're talking about basic security, fire, water, especially education. And so in the Great Lakes region, you could call this the front lines. Tarana, why don't you open with a beginning description of what's going on?
Sure. Well, the thing that is most clear that I can say, just to give a general sense from our organizing in the last 2 weeks or so, is that really anything is possible right now. We have a completely wide-open situation where people are angry and they're ready to be led. They're ready to mobilize around a solution. But you also have the potential for a French Revolution-type situation where these kind of protests that people are seeing in the news in Wisconsin, in Ohio, and other states in the Midwestern region, for that kind of situation to explode and, as we're seeing with the global mass strike, end up in chaos and the, Louis the 16th type situation. So what we've brought to this mass strike is the real solutions that we are saying these guys should rally around as a flag to to make a demand and say, what we need is to reinstate the Glass-Steagall Law. We need to go after Wall Street and the City of London, and that's the real enemy. That's the real real enemy that these people have. Because what's being created is this whole false discussion around teachers and firefighters and unions in general being the problem and getting people to be pitted against each other, as opposed to identifying the real enemy and the real road to the solution, which is, you know, destroying that enemy, that common enemy that we share. So what we've done, we've mostly been on the ground in Ohio, where people might know or, you know, might have heard, there's a very, basically a similar situation to what broke in Wisconsin a couple weeks ago, where you have newly elected governor, won by a very small margin, just fascist economic policy, and are going for, specifically right now, the repeal of any kind of collective bargaining for state workers. And so that includes teachers, firefighters, etc. And we attended a town hall meeting that was being held by a couple state legislators and state senator. And this town hall meeting was being held specifically so that working families could provide testimony at this town hall meeting and speak out about this Senate Bill 5, as it's called, this attack on collective bargaining. And what was notable from this town hall meeting was the abundance of especially teachers that were there, and the real frustration of these people who, as one teacher put it, he said, you know, look, I became a teacher knowing that I was never going to be rich, and I saw my other friends go off and, you know, go into more lucrative professions, and I chose to be a teacher because I wanted to teach kids. I wanted to give something to the future. I knew I wasn't going to make a lot of money, and now I'm just wondering how I'm supposed to even make a living, because I'm being attacked as if I'm the problem. And I know that if this bill goes through, we're not going to make it. We're, you know, we almost, the only thing that we were able to keep during this whole breakdown was our home, and now I know we're going to lose our home. And there was testimony after testimony with that sentiment, to the point, you know, some had even were to the point of tears, that they weren't going to be able to provide certain materials for their students and supplies. Some teachers were talking about how they would make sure that their kids, their classroom kids were fed, because they didn't have, you know, they were too poor and or provided materials for them, and that they weren't going to be able to do this if this kind of attack on these state workers is successful. So what we brought to the discussion was the point that this isn't just a group of fascist Republican governors, that this is a policy that's coming from the top, and that both President Obama and these governors are complicit in pushing for massive austerity right now. And one other thing that's worth reporting from this town hall meeting was the testimony that a firefighter provided, who said, look, what I'm wondering is how the discussion was changed from a year ago being going after Wall Street and these bailouts to firefighters and teachers being the problem and the people who should be cut. And so what we brought, as I was saying, to the discussion was, look, if we do want to go after Wall Street, if we want to go after these bailouts, the way to do it is to immediately pass the Glass-Steagall Law, to wipe out these bailouts, allow immediate relief for the states, and in the long term, revive production, development in this country, and get young people especially to work in skilled, productive jobs. And then we've also been present just at the different rallies and protests going on at the Capitol in Columbus in Ohio, where there's been several thousand people there. We were getting out the six candidates leaflet on the global mass strike demanding Glass-Steagall, which people were very open to. Everyone was grabbing them up. They were going like hotcakes. And what we were seeing in the crowd over the course of the day was at first just kind of a, you know, anger, kind of, you know, protesting, people bringing up the governor and how his employees make this much money, and why are they talking about cutting us when he makes this much money? And we were really able to elevate the discussion to a higher level of, you know, changing the subject away from the teachers and the state workers being the problem to, as I said, Wall Street and these bailouts, and that's the real flag, that if these guys want to be successful in saving their livelihoods and their state and their country, that they've got to take the fight to the highest level and make a demand for something. And that if they're just protesting against these fascist cuts, whether they're successful or not in stopping this Senate bill, we're still going to be in the same situation. The states are going to be bankrupt, and there's going to be no solution that would allow for a real recovery, their personal situation and our, you know, for our states and our country. So that's just an immediate picture of what's going on the ground. There's some more kind of anecdotes, but I'll leave it there for now.
You know, it's worth mentioning that, I mean, in any kind of a real economic sense, that teachers and firefighters and policemen are necessary features of an economy, whereas we don't need investment bankers. We don't need Wall Street. You know, so if we need to cut some things, I think we should, as you suggested, we go with Glass-Steagall and begin cutting those people, because they're just parasites.
You know, that's funny that you say that, John, because one of the kind of shifts that happened that we saw at the rally itself with all these thousands of people was when one of the union guys got up there, and this is the first kind of mention of Wall Street in the public discussion, where the guy said, look, who on Wall Street is taking a pay cut? Is, you know, are the guys at J.P. Morgan taking a cut? Why aren't we discussing Wall Street? And he started chanting Wall Street, and, you know, the whole crowd was at a certain point chanting that. So there is, if leadership is presented, if the discussion, the solutions are put forward, people are just ready to respond. But there has to be the leadership provided, because otherwise it just sinks to this, you know, political infighting, don't cut me, cut them kind of discussion.
Well, you know, I think some of them should be allowed to earn salary. I don't know what the prevailing wage in a federal prison is these days. But some of these investment bankers might be able to contribute some small measure, you know, stamping out license plates or something.
Tarana, let me ask you more about some of the rallies or all the different circumstances in which you've been talking to people. What about the shift in now appreciation or disgust at Obama's role as flunky for all of this kind of thing?
Yeah, that's something that's just very clear from all of our discussions, is that there are very few people left who are defending Obama. For instance, at this town hall meeting, which is, you know, largely African-American working family members, we had two organizers, candidate Bill Roberts and another organizer also speak and provide testimony. And the real point that they made, as I mentioned, is that this goes to the top, and that President Obama is complicit in these policies by name. And there was no disagreement. There was silence and there was tension in the room, but there was no no vocal opposition to that point. And once we prodded at that more the next day at this, you know, several thousand person rally where we were getting out the Global Mass Strike leaflet, which explicitly goes after Obama and his hyperinflationary, you know, British policy, people were listening and agreeing and saying, and there's just no defense left of Obama. People know. For instance, President Obama was off meeting with the governor of Ohio, who's ramming through these fascist cuts, John Kasich, in Cleveland, Ohio, the same day last week that, you know, there were thousands of people protesting his policy in the Capitol. So where is Obama? No one knows. He's off shaking hands with the fascist governor that they're protesting. So there's nothing really left in terms of a defense of President Obama. The main challenge now is to get people to actually join us and fight with us and say this. Because there's not disagreement, but there's kind of a fear of breaking out of a party line or, you know, the accepted political lines that are drawn. So individually, people are open, they're responding, they're ready to be in contact with us. But what we're working on is getting those individuals who are willing to break from popular opinion and join our call on the state level to the federal level for the reinstatement of Glass-Steagall. Because not only were we doing organizing in the, you know, the protests and the rallies outside, but we had meetings all day long inside with the state representatives, sitting down with them on both sides of the aisle and saying, look, if you don't want to be a fascist budget cutter and be condemning your population to their death or, you know, complete poverty, then you've got to join with us. It's the only thing to do right now is make this call for Glass-Steagall. And there right now, it's very interesting, the response that we've gotten from these state representatives, especially Republicans, who the ones who don't want to go with this party line are very open, very curious about Glass-Steagall, asking a lot of questions. And some offices are also in the process of, you know, a dialogue with other offices on moving forward with something. So I don't have anything specific on that I can report now, but I can say that it's a very open situation, and we could see something very interesting coming out of that work that we've been doing there.
Yeah, perhaps the dynamic is indicated. I'm speaking from as a person at some distance from this, from Ohio, but what you say, even in the vote for the SB5, and this isn't, everything's not going to be decided by parliamentary means, by any means, but one of the Republicans who voted against the Republican bill, his son is a firefighter, a policeman. I think he lost his life in the line of duty a year ago. And So every individual, as you're saying, is on the line to break out of whatever social control mode might prevent them from taking making the break and taking necessary action as a citizen. Is there any special thing regarding the different layers of and kinds of people in motion? You mentioned you mentioned about teachers, mentioned about firefighters or police. Is anything that you and others do that you find a particular response about that helps people break out? I mean, take Ohio. Bill Roberts himself, I think, and others have been there fighting for the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act of LaRouche from a couple of years, fighting for the Ohio locks and dams, fighting for a development approach. Does that particularly reach into people about returning to the development perspective that some of them may still feel for this part of the world?
Yeah. Well, the real clincher to most of our discussions has been the question of how really are we going to create revenue and wealth for the state? Because as they well know, whether they're a Republican or Democrat, they know that anything that's being offered to them as a policy right now in terms of these budget cuts or taxing the rich or whatever, you know, schemes are being come up with right now, that none of those things are going to address the real cause of why the state and all of the states to one degree or another in the country are in this situation in the first place. And that's also something that gets through to people very clearly who are protesting, is that you got to think about why we're even in the situation where now teachers and firefighters, et cetera, are being attacked as the source of the problem. That what we've got to look at is a 40-year process of deregulation, of deindustrialization, and really the destruction, especially of that region and the high quality of manufacturing and skill sets, the machine tools, and all of this that was the lifeblood of this region. And that's something that really people here in Ohio, Michigan, really identify with, and it's clear to them and really does move the, you know, people who are more open and ready to move really does get to their imaginations and give them a sense of why LaRouche's policies around not just Glass-Steagall, but building the WAPA, the North American Water and Power Alliance, and the role that the Midwest would play in that project, why those are really the only solution to this economic collapse right now, that nothing else is going to work, that there is no short-term Band-Aid or, you know, stitch, or maybe if we cut collective bargaining now, you know, then we can give it back in 2 years once the recovery hits us. And people know that's not going to happen, and it's not the intention of these guys.
Yeah, that's impressive. It is outstanding that most state budgets, certainly you're talking about Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, but across the country, 30-some percent is for Medicaid, which is for the poor. If people weren't poor, 30% of the state budget wouldn't be going to Medicaid. And then the other 30-40%, which is a good thing, to education, so it only leaves 20-40% for other functions. So as you say, if you're going to cut health care for the poor and education, this is a death sentence. So John, you've been making the point, to quote you, people are showing resistance to being destroyed, right?
Yeah, that these policies, basically, this is genocide. And that, you know, the fundamental problem with the United States economy is not in the financial realm. The fundamental problem is in the physical economy, that we quit producing, that we shut down our industrial economy, as Toronto was saying. We failed to make the leap to nuclear power. We failed to upgrade our whole economy to higher levels of technology. And in fact, we've been drawing down and using up what infrastructure we have left so that we don't produce anymore. Instead, you know, we were seduced by this this banker's plot, in which they call globalization, which is, you know, the creation of moving all the jobs offshore, the creation of these international financial markets and things like that, which has proven to be an absolute disaster. And then the financial games come in when, as a substitute for having a real economy, then the Inner Alpha Group and others set up a casino inside the United States, basically. They turned our economy into a casino, and now this casino has blown up. So we no longer have a physical economy to produce anything, which is the real problem. And we were given a casino to create all this funny money, and now that's blown up. So now we have no financial economy, no physical economy, and the federal government and the Federal Reserve are doing everything they can do to save the funny money, the casino. And all the emphasis is going on cutting spending to the real economy, you know, slashing Social Security, slashing all kinds of other payments, and, you know, it's all being funded by the top people on Wall Street and, you know, all the billionaires. Now, these are the same grouping that through the bailout has sucked enormous sums of money out of the U.S. government, is now turning around and lecturing the government on being fiscally irresponsible. These idiots blew up the world. They got us to bail them out in one of the sleaziest criminal moves ever known, and now they have the nerve to lecture us that we're spendthrifts. You know, I mean, the fact that we tolerate this is incredible. And the only way to turn this whole thing around, you just start off, you have to shut down the casino, and that's what Glass-Steagall will do that. We have to reassert our national sovereignty, and we have to impose harsh regulations on these banks, keep them under control, and go back to physical productivity. And if we don't do that, you know, then we're not going to make it. But that's the problem. Looting teachers and looting firefighters and shutting down governments. I mean, the federal government job figures, which are hardly reliable and generally understate things seriously, but even the federal government says that the state and local governments have cut back over 450,000 jobs since the fall of 2008. I mean, this is getting really serious.
Yeah, I think that we don't need objective facts here. I just can't help throw in that some of the proposals at large, as in Wisconsin, that we don't need to have any government function to check on the safety of water. What the hey? We don't need, you know, the thing is crazy. Of course, we are dealing with the insanity, and it's a killer insanity to say you don't need these government workers or their functions.
Yeah. Well, you know, once we get rid of all the government workers, then we can sell off all the public infrastructure to the private financial interests, you know, and they can charge us to drive on the roads that taxpayer money built, charge us to use the water systems that taxpayer money built, and all of that, and that can all be done, you know, via Enron-type private operations, you know, and you can just continue to loot the economy into the ground, which is the plan, because there is no recovery. There's no intent in having a recovery. The global economy is being dramatically downsized. You know, the Prince Philip has made it clear the British Empire policy is cut world population by two-thirds, which means that a lot of people have to die. It means that you shut off the governments. The governments tend to defend living standards of populations. At least they used to. You know, that's their job. And so now the idea is to smash all national governments and have a world run by corporate cartels. And this has been publicly stated. You know, and so this is what has to be stopped. We're headed down a road which is going to lead into a new dark age. Unless we reverse this and put the empire, put the monetary system down and go with an American style credit system. And you know, if we don't do that, you know, there is no way out. That's the issue, that's the problem. It's not the teachers in Wisconsin.
Well, Tarana, in this regard, let me ask you a specific question. Or if you want to make general points, but among the many kind of mind control aspects of what John's describing about this imperial genocide globalization has been this terrible green think, zero growth, alternative energy, and so forth. Do you find in discussions with people in any, whether it's a big crowd or one-on-one, that this is, too, there's a big shift here that people who might have put up with this now find it repulsive?
Well, it's a varied response that we get. One thing I know that we've run into both in Michigan at the state legislature in Lansing and also in Columbus in Ohio is kind of a last desperate grab to make the argument that green jobs such as solar collectors and building parts for windmills can be considered as manufacturing jobs.
Okay.
And that somehow this is going to keep these states and their manufacturing sectors going. But there is really, that's minimal, and it falls away very quickly. I think a lot of it is people paying lip service to that because they think that's all there is that's going to, you know, bring any money into their state. But when we make this point on the scientific level that these things are, you know, dark age technologies, that they are net loss in terms of power, and that they're a total fraud, and as LaRouche says, that any solar collectors and windmills that have been built to this point should probably be gotten rid of, and we can do something far better, like a nuclear renaissance and plant a bunch more trees instead. That people respond to that and almost kind of say, you know, yeah, I know, like, I know, you're right.
Okay.
So there's a very paper thin, you know, kind of hold on that ideology. But what we really need, what's clear, is that there's just a void of a real idea of how we're going to revive real manufacturing, how we're going to get back on the track of what has made our nation the best, at its best, which is great projects, science driver, mission, long-term planning, where it's not the immediate moment and the immediate crisis and fiscal concerns of the moment are governing policy, but as Jason Ross's video on LaRouche Pack TV on what is value very clearly outlines, it's really an excellent video for anyone to watch who hasn't seen it, that what we need is a real, the future and what we want to accomplish one or two generations down the line for that to shape our policy and what we need to be doing now. And the perfect example of this is the Nawapa project, which there's a really a huge excitement and openness to that we've found here, especially with the steel workers, with a couple other different trade unions that we've had individual meetings with, and also at the university in Michigan, and also especially in the civil engineering and construction management departments of the universities, which is, you know, where we've had the most kind of discussion on Nawapa so far. So that outreach is also, we're going to continue that into these different institutional layers who are going to be crucial to mobilize and organize around Nawapa and around calling for that kind of development project is the only way we're going to really get an arsenal of democracy back in this area of the country.
Yeah, thanks. In fact, that's what I was going to ask you about before the hour is finished. I don't know if you want to say more on it, but it's been, but of course, you're part of the world where you're, where you're organizing right now has had echelons over the decades of specialists in logistics and civil engineering, as you mentioned, electrical engineering, going back to Detroit Edison, early nuclear plants in Michigan and Western Pennsylvania, and they were wanting to do it in the Middle East. And the response that you're getting in whatever you, in the contact work, people may have seen on LPAC TV, your interview with John O'Doherty, who's retired, I think, from the Michigan Transportation. Department of Transportation,
yeah.
On rail. But there's still a long wave. Some of these people first became active in the 1960s or earlier. Of if you want to say more about it, of people who can, who have special expertise and special appreciation for restoring the idea of taking action based on the future.
Yeah, well, one of the real kind of immediate difficulties in doing outreach in these sectors that those people are, a lot of them are retired now, so they're not working at the universities. You know, mostly the people teaching classes, professors at the universities are, a lot of them now in the engineering and construction management departments are originally from other countries. So that's kind of an initial challenge that we've faced is kind of reactivating and digging out of the networks of contacts that we're talking with, those people who do have the decades of experience and kind of an important spirit or memory of a different orientation that the United States had in the Kennedy era, you know, going back to Franklin Roosevelt, that whole period. So, you know, we're continuing to kind of activate those networks and just kind of find those people by getting the word out there, getting to as many people as we can, and just getting kind of following the threads that we get access to, pulling on them and seeing what we find. But for instance, this interview with John O'Doherty was great in the sense that he's got a whole lifetime of experience with rail and transport, gave us a really, really fun picture of what would need to be reactivated and recreated in this country in terms of the rail grid and rail network for the kind of transportation of materials and supplies from the Midwest area to the construction site areas and along the NWAPA project in Canada along the West Coast, which is one of the questions that we've been kind of, you know, posing to anyone that we've met with and trying to get a better picture of what actually would be required in terms of the increased steel production in this Midwest area, what companies would be involved in that, and also what kind of improvement in the transportation, the rail grid, would be necessary to allow for that ramping up of production in this area and, you know, getting those supplies out there to the West Coast.
Right, that seems clear. I can understand what he was describing, the whole recent 50-year history of the takedown of the rail grid in the country. Let me ask you one other thing is, too, Tarana, is you've recently had, it was in Dearborn last Saturday, in fact, a town hall meeting,
mm-hmm.
and there you were, had certain kind of discussions formally, I'm sure informally. Do you want to say about anything, any particular aspect of this process of what you're doing?
Yeah, sure.
Go ahead.
Well, I guess there's two features to this town hall meeting that are notable to report. One is the presentation that Bill Roberts, you know, our congressional candidate for the Michigan Midwest area, that he gave, where he really got into the question of why, how did we get to the point that we are saying or going along with, or the discussion is being posed in the context that people are going to have to die for the sake of maintaining a money system, as John mentioned earlier. How did we get to that point, and how do we get out of it? What actually is the discussion that we should be creating around a real economy and what real wealth is? And he went through some discussion on Henry Carey, the real American system creators, proponents in our own history, the United States, that demonstrates that they had a completely different outlook than the underlying theories of our current imperial monetarist system, which go back to this British liberal economics, which is exactly what we fought the American Revolution against, the exact ideology that we rebelled from and founded our nation in opposition to. He had some really fun polemics against, you know, this Malthusian idea of, you know, population and the need to limit population growth because of our inability to feed a certain amount of people. And that real way that Henry Carey, for instance, refuted this whole discussion was through his scientific network, people he was in touch with who were doing soil development, chemistry, and their outlook was that nature, that man's role in nature is to constantly be improving our environment, improving our knowledge of how the universe works, and increasing our population and increasing the condition of life of man. So that's a completely different outlook than, you know, this genocidal British policy that's being forced on us now. That really, I think, got at a much deeper level of discussion in the Q&A session and the discussion we had afterwards than kind of this surface political false debate about, you know, who should be cut or who's the problem or this kind of thing. And then the other thing worth noting is that following the presentations, we played the 40-minute video that can be found on LaRouche Pack TV by Cody Jones and Michelle Fuchs on the science of Glass-Steagall. And so we watched it and then kind of broke off into smaller discussion groups and had some really good discussion on how this idea of looking at the development of the biosphere and how it's actually anti-entropic inequality, meaning that it's not limited and limited to having to, you know, just continue to collapse and decay, but that even the biosphere is constantly, in a sense, improving upon its own labor, as man does, and going to higher and higher levels of organization. And that not only does the biosphere do that, but mankind does it as well. That it's not man against nature, but we're actually following the laws of the universe around us when we act in that way. And if we don't act in that way, we're actually going backwards. And that's a necessary discussion to be had. It's not just some kind of cute analogy like, oh, look, you know, the biosphere developed anti-entropically, and that's a case to be made for why we should continue to develop and, you know, build, create new platforms of development for mankind. So that was really a kind of a breakthrough in the sense that we haven't really done this kind of thing as much, you know, in the town hall meeting kind of environment. But it really shows the potential for people to have that quality and level of discussion, that people are hungry for ideas right now and ready to think and be challenged rather than just go along with the kind of the false culture of slogans, sound bites, and really non-thinking that has been forced on our culture and our nation over the recent decades.
Right. Well, Tarana, let me segue into something here and ask John, because what you raise, which is very exciting, about the idea of self-improvement in the universe, and Bill Roberts using Henry Carey or others to talk about development of agriculture potential and so forth as a natural thing, as the what is man and nature together, it brings me to a negative, an aspect of the opposite of that, the way the imperialist, the empire, just conducts itself. And John, you were talking on the weekly, you with Lyndon LaRouche were talking on your weekly report this week about what they called the Monsanto factor. That in fact, under globalization, there's been such food control, I mean, such shortages, such deprivation. I mean, you see masses of people without food or the means to get food. But you have a new rumor you want to put out on this show, you've heard, I think.
Well, you know, you look at the way what Tarana described as an outlook is really a beautiful outlook, and then you compare that to the oligarchic way of thinking. You know, first of all, it's worth pointing out that all of this development of the universe did not involve money in any way. And that's a point that shouldn't be lost. And that the idea you have in Monsanto of patenting life, of claiming to own life forms, and, you know, charge people, and they have this whole police state apparatus which runs around enforcing a patent they should never be allowed to have.
Yeah, you have to pay a license fee or a trait.
You know, but, yeah, so the next move, I think, for them, and they're probably working on it now, is to try to patent death so that everybody who dies also has to pay a tax on the way out. And, you know, that way they get you coming and going. But
Okay. That
really, I mean, that represents the oligarchy outlook. And so they see everything in terms of what they could price gouge out of it. If you look at the manipulations on the price of oil, which translate into higher prices for virtually everything. If you look at the way in which, you know, the Enron model for the electricity business, if you look at the way food and other commodities are turned into things to speculate on, that what you see is you have this market system, this parasitic system, which is committed to charging people the maximum they can for the necessities of life in order to, you know, this accomplishes two things at once. One is it makes them a significant amount of money, and two, you know, if you keep the prices high enough, it pushes people over the edge, which, you know, gives you the genocide, the sort of controlled genocide they want to see. And, you know, this is, from an economic standpoint, this is all insane. Because, you know, if you take the case of electricity, for example, you want an economy to have electricity, an ample supply of electricity, as cheaply as possible, because the electricity increases the productive power of human labor. So your economy is much more efficient if your electricity is cheap. You know, so you want to make sure you have plenty of it. You know, this idea that people have to turn off their air conditioners whenever there's a heat wave is criminal. You want energy prices in general to be low. You want to have, you know, the most effective and efficient forms of energy you can have, which means you go to nuclear power. That all of these things, the government should have a role in making sure that we have ample supplies and stable prices for this to create the basis then by which the private sector can run a productive economy. And this is all being left out in this rush for privatization and, you know, the idea that, you know, food is a profit center. When people are starving around the world, you know, under globalization, we take food from starving countries and we import it to the United States because we've shut down a lot of our own food production. You know, and this kind of thinking is just absolutely deadly. But this is the way that the markets work, you know. But this is really, this is a return to the ideas of the old British East India Company, which is what globalization really is. It's sort of British East India Company meets modern computerized logistics. And, you know, the argument is made by the bankers and others that, you know, we have to have modern financial regulation. But modern regulation is what FDR did to assert the power of the nation state over the imperial monetary system. That was modern. Everything that's been done since FDR died has been to tear down that modern system and go back to what there was before, which is the imperial model. You know, so we really have to take all of this, all of these ideas that have come in with the bubble and come in with this imperial monetary system, and throw them all out and go back to precisely the kind of thinking that Toronto was describing.
Yeah, Toronto, do you want to, let me ask you in particular, you may want to say more about any aspect of this in our final quarter here. I want you to make sure and throw in anything you wish. But what do you find that, do you have any insight into what, when people themselves had signs about we are Egypt or we're with Egypt or what, what do you, how are people, what do you feel this signifies as you've been in these situations?
Well, first off, I think it's these signs like walk like an Egyptian and,
okay,
you know, Mubarak and first Mubarak, Scott Walker's next, or, you know, those kinds of things. It's more than just some kind of sense of solidarity, which, you know, I know that's how it's discussed and reported, which is true, that is a factor. But really what it is people, to one degree or another, have a sense right now that this is something bigger than their local struggle at the, you know, local town hall. And that was that's been expressed to us explicitly in the organizing that we've done in Ohio in these rallies, where people were saying, yeah, you know, this is wild. This is happening all over the world, and it's happening at the same time. And, you know, they might not know exactly the full depth of the cause as we know from working with LaRouche and the work that we've done on these genocidal policies, deregulation, globalization, as John Hopel went through. But they know, they have a sense that there's some larger process going on than just some kind of spreading Twitter, Facebook revolution, or some kind of isolated protest around the world that just happened to be happening at the same time. That there's some kind of underlying shift or potential that's coming to a head right now, and a real existential question about the future of our civilization. and that this is something that goes beyond nations. And people, you know, they're not, I mean, they do say, at least in the Midwest, well, you know, it's not as bad as Egypt or Bahrain or something, but they know that it's the same process, the same demand for a future that's driving this kind of global mass strike. And I would just like to add that LaRouche was exactly right when he said, coming out of the November 2nd election of last year, that people who had voted in these, right-wing fascists, that they really didn't know what they were voting for, and that it was going to be something completely different than what they had thought. And most of these people were voting, this was a reaction against Obama and against this Hitler T4 healthcare reform policy that he, so foolishly attempted, or maybe malevolently, we're not sure, tried to ram through as his first step coming into office. Everything, the whole situation that we're seeing unfolding now is a result of those policies that Obama represented and the counter-reaction to him in the population, and now something that's coming down the pipes that's even worse than, you know, what people thought they were fleeing away from in the form of President Obama. Now they get the combination of right-left fascism that really is no different when it comes down to the policies that are going to destroy the American people. So what we're seeing now is that it's really, in terms of the American population, there's no disagreement around the policy solutions. An end to the bailout and some kind of recovery and revitalization of the productive sector of this country. No matter where people think they are, the Tea Party or Democrats or whatever on the political spectrum, that's the reality of what people want right now, what they know is needed. So this whole kind of false creation of this separation of Republicans and Democrats and Obama can't get anything done because the Republicans are blocking it is just a complete lie that's being imposed on the discussion. And really, if there's the leadership that we're providing is successful, that whole facade is just going to fall away. Because when it comes down to it, like I said, there is no disagreement in anyone in the population right now who's looking for some kind of real solution for the future of this nation. And that's the level that we have to address people on, and not compromise because of fear of some kind of, you know, breaking political boundaries or something like that.
Yes, I see what you mean, and I'm sure when you're amidst the situation, it can be very moralizing when people who, as you were saying, feel, gee, there is something much bigger here that we're all together responding to. It's a question of what we're going to do and who can do it. John, you were at a meeting with Mr. LaRouche and staff this morning, where I understand he was talking about our job being to address the human creative factor in everyone, no matter what miserable situation they've been in for a while, in terms of social, you know, just too many decades of pop music, too much time spent without being able to do anything productive, but to address this in people. Do you want to mention anything?
Yeah, I mean, we have within each of us the either the creativity or the potential for that creativity to understand how the universe is organized, to discover universal physical principles and to act on those discoveries in a way that changes the environment in which we operate. We, you know, if you look at the history of mankind, that's what we've done. We've changed the planet. We've raised the standard of living. We've transformed virtually everything, and we can continue to do this. You know, we went from the first manned flight to putting a man on the moon in a little over six decades. You know, we can do these things. We can develop new technologies that end the idea of a scarcity of resources. There is no scarcity of resources on this planet. There's merely a lack of technology to take to use the resources that are available. So there are no shortages. If we keep developing, if we keep making these breakthroughs and, you know, organizing our economy around making these breakthroughs, there are no shortages. There are no problems that we can't solve. It's when we get stupid and start spending all of our time in the casino that we run out of things. And the idea that, you know, you treat all of these the resources you have, you want to milk them to the last, milk the last dollar out of them, that's the oligarchy's mindset. And we should just leave all that behind. We don't need them. We don't need Wall Street. We don't need any of this because, you know, we have the power. We have the form of government with our Constitution. People should read the preamble and act accordingly. Let's change the world, change the universe.
Right. Now, one thing, let me ask you, Tehran, I don't know if you've crossed the Michigan line or where you are right now, but I want to stress to everyone who's listening, we often have a listenership after the live period here. We're, of course, archived on LaRouchePub.com. Some people have special connections via telephone message line as well. But March 10th, that is on Thursday at 1 o'clock Eastern Time, will be the next international webcast by Lyndon LaRouche, United States and Ireland, Ireland, the United States. And are you, Tehran, and people often listen as a group or listen in different settings together, university or others, Union Hall and so forth, but or do you have anything special you want to say about this?
Well, yeah, two things. I can give you a sense of what we'll be doing for that in a minute, but on this idea of Ireland and America, one thing that kind of surprised us that was really resonating with people, especially in these protest rallies in Ohio, was just telling people about what had happened in Ireland. And people were almost drawn over, you know, as soon as they'd come up and say, well, did you hear about what happened in Ireland? You know, that you had the same kind of attempt to ram through one of these austerity bailout for the bank packages, and then the Irish people rejected this, and you know, the real leadership of the country, which was a small grouping who historically, you know, got 1% and that kind of thing in the polls, now this party has taken a real leadership role for the country, and because of their explicit rejection of the bailouts and the repeating that there will not be one red cent given to these banks, these supranational banks for the bailouts while having to cut their people, that will not be done and they will not tolerate that. And that it was on that ground that they got the kind of support in this recent election that the Sinn Féin party got. That's something that really was gripping people and really exciting them about what is possible here in the United States. So I look forward to whatever discussion Mr. LaRouche will give on Thursday on that. Here in the Midwest area, our plans are to continue the work we've been doing also at the universities, which I didn't get to say much about, but we've had a lot of success very recently just going to the classrooms and addressing the classes on what's happening and, you know, just getting people's contacts and emails to be in touch with them. So we'll be having probably some showings, a showing or two at universities, perhaps one at our office for the other contacts and, you know, firefighters and teachers and those kinds of circles that we've been organizing. So that's what we'll have going on here.
Well, that's terrific. And I wanted to make the point, this is the time people should give their resources, their money, their time, give today and also tomorrow. And especially just the activities that Tehran just described. And I will say that March 10th, the LaRouche webcast is something that's a must. We may have Helga Zepp LaRouche be able to be with us on this show live March 12th, and especially contribute because March 17th is St. Patrick's Day. And I want to thank Tarana Dorsey from Speaking from the Front Lines, LaRouche Political Action Committee in the Great Lakes States. Thank you, Tarana. And John Hofel. So this will be March 5th, the LaRouche Show. Marcia Mary Baker signing off.